There's a slogan I've seen on T-shirts and I think on bumper stickers says, born to shop. And you and I know people, probably our teenage daughters, to whom that applies. I mean, if shopping was competitive, they could shop for Australia. It was an Olympic event, they'd be gold medalists. Shopping is part of our consumer society. But what's going on here when shopping is a major recreation? Philip Jensen can explain. Philip, the Dean of Sydney, how are you?
Well, I'm well, thanks, but I'm also thinking of the other one, you know, shop till you drop.
Yes, that's a familiar, that's another one,
isn't it? Shop till drop, yes.
Yes, and there are surveys showing that shopping is a really popular recreational activity.
It's fascinating, isn't it, that you think, you know, of all the things that you could do, especially in a lovely outdoor country like Australia,
yes,
to spend your time in shopping malls wandering around.
So, explain to us the role that, consumerism is playing in our culture. Where does it fit in? What's it doing?
Well, one of the things is seeing it, and it's like air. You can't see it because it's everywhere.
Yes, fish don't know they're wet.
I guess
they're surrounded by water.
Yes. I guess that's the case.
And we're
yes.
surrounded by. Well, by pushing this metaphor,
the materialism is just part of our society.
Yes,
and you only know it when you move to a non-materialist society, or when you go back into history studies, or when you turn into the Bible and you have a different value system. Well. There are certain things that go with materialism, as we have it today. Individualism is one thing, that the centre of all activity is the self, is the individual.
What I want.
What I want, yes. And another one is consumerism, that the value of life lies in what I own, what I possess. And that what makes me happy is to own and possess more or newer or better. And I've got to keep on possessing, I've got to keep owning.
So if I'm feeling a bit dissatisfied, it's because I don't own the right stuff or the newest stuff or the best stuff.
The thing that will, yes, that's right. And yes. The thing that will really make my life worthwhile. If I just had that pair of shoes or that tie or that car. And so I keep purchasing all the time. And it's profound amongst the addicts who shop till they drop. But it also is, it's profound amongst those who envy.
Right.
Because it's built on covetousness, because my neighbour has this, and the latest people have that, or the celebrities have this kind of thing.
But even if we're not addicts, it's the sort of thing we can just be doing all the time because it's the way we live, it's the way our society works.
Yes.
Just buying things is the function of life, in a sense.
It's the economic structure of our life.
Right.
Consumerist economics is how economics... If you're in a Marxist state... then production dominates. But if you're in a free enterprise, especially a really free market, then the consumer is king, as one famous economist said. And so whatever the consumer wants is what we produce.
But
if the consumer doesn't want it, we don't produce those things.
But it does mean the value of everything is its cash value.
Yes.
It's its dollar number, isn't it?
Yes. If it can't be sold, it's valueless.
Right.
It's useless. It's away.
So what does that do to things that we don't pay for, like volunteers, for example, who don't get paid for their work?
Yeah, well, it pushes volunteerism to the side all the time. Because one man said to me once, he was coming to retirement, and I said, well, what are you going to do in your retirement? And he said, oh, I'm not sure. You know. I said, well, there's lots of voluntary things to do. He said, oh, I wouldn't do anything voluntary. And I said, why not? And he said, well, if people aren't willing to pay for it, then they don't value it. If they don't value it, why should I?
Right, yes. That's so, consumerist thinking, isn't it?
It's consumerist thinking.
What about our churches? Does that sort of thinking come into our churches?
It goes through everything. Unless you purposely and intentionally think otherwise, or unless you live in a society that is not driven by economics, you will by nature think in a consumerist fashion. And so it'll come into church. It comes into schools. When I was at a PNC, I remember years ago, they were having trouble getting volunteers to work in the kiosk, in the tuck shop, or whatever we called it. And that was because so many mothers were now going to work, they didn't have enough volunteers to continue to run it. And so the answer is, we pay for it. And then you start to see the advantages of paying for it, because that meant you wouldn't have the days when the volunteer fell sick and didn't turn up, and you'd be able to direct what was or wasn't sold in the shop better, because it wasn't volunteers making
the decisions. You get some orders, yes.
And they said, well, it'd be better for us to have paid people there. And
right.
Now, the price meant everything was more expensive and or there was no profits to the PNC, but that's all right. The PNC would never have to worry about the kiosk anymore.
Right.
That's off our agenda. We don't have to worry about that now.
And it's a shift which is comfortable for us because it's what's comfortable in a consumerist society to do it that way.
Yes.
So a local church, instead of getting the blokes to volunteer to mow the lawns around the church, could get someone who runs the local lawn mowing business to come and mow the church and the lawns and pay for it.
That's right. And it means someone's got a job, which is a good thing. It means the lawns are mowed properly. You know, I mean, the week that you were on wasn't done very well, whereas this bloke, he will do it properly, and it means we can demand standards, which we can't demand of
volunteers. And it won't ever get too long, because we'll insist he comes back every two weeks.
And those kinds of things. So there's lots of advantages in having it done professionally as consumers, and all we need to do is raise our giving to be able to do it. And so in our affluence, in our enormous amount of wealth that we've had, we can then relate to everybody in terms of being paying for things.
But if I'm paying the minister, then I'm going to demand that the minister delivers my money's worth.
Yes. So my consumerist ideas will now come across to each person that I pay, and church becomes a provider of goods and services, which I can demand certain standards of. Now, don't get me wrong, it's not that I want church to be sloppy particularly, but there are professional standards that can be required of people who are paid that are not there of people who aren't. So no one thinks of your family meal has to have professional standards.
Yes.
You know, it can be muck in and slop around because, say, this is all family. But church is no longer family. Church is a business.
And we want it to be, you know, there's this assumption that we want it to be like that. So there's a volunteer on the sound desk at the church who gets bits right and bits wrong.
Yeah.
And we find that frustrating because we live in a society where you pay for everything and you get professional standards.
That's right. Now, little churches who function like families, they don't mind the fact that Freddie's reading the Bible and he keeps calling Gentiles gentles instead or something like that. Because, hey, it's Freddie. We all know Freddie. He's one of us. And he'll get better in the years to come and we're listening. And I know what he means and it's all right. But when you get into a big church, you can't tolerate little Freddie. It's no longer, hey, he's one of us. They say, who's that idiot out there? Why don't they get someone who can do it properly? Why don't you have training? What are we paying the clergy for if they're not going to train people to read the Bible properly or read it themselves properly?
I'm not getting my money's worth.
No. Yeah. So we have this. I mean, one of the worst ones I remember some years ago was a youth group where the numbers were fairly erratic. And I talked to some of the parents about it and they said, well, look, the youth worker is paid whether our kids go there or not. So he's all right. He's getting paid. And our kids, we can choose, hey, this week we're not going to go because we're going to go to a family birthday party. So the group as a group had no sense of loyalty, no sense of commitment, no sense of community. There was provided something for money for the church families to go to.
And when it suits us, we choose to go because it's the service is there and it's all being paid for.
Yeah. That's consumerist thinking, although most people, that's called the love of money. But if you say to people, you shall not love money, they say, well, no, I don't kiss banknotes. You know, what does it mean, love of money? Well, consumerism is the love of money because it comes out of materialism.
And the real danger is we're living that way without recognising it because we're just absorbing it through our skin.
Because our society is doing it all the time in everything.
So you talked about the love of money. So what does the Bible say about that consumerist culture that we're caught up in, whether we know it or not?
Well, what does it say about money? I mean, the world is created and is a good thing. And so there's nothing wrong with the material existence of this world. Silver is mine, the gold is mine, says God. So there's nothing wrong with money. The love of money is the root of all evil, and covetousness, envy, is always wrong. And therefore, it's very hard for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven.
The implication seems to be the more money people have got, the more important it's going to be to them, the more they're going to love it, hence hard for the rich.
That's right. Now, 1 Timothy 6, towards the end of the chapter, he speaks to the rich, and he doesn't say, give away your money, like Jesus did to the rich young ruler, but he says, don't be arrogant, because money makes me think I'm important, because I can get things done at the drop of a hat. If I want this, I just pay for it, it's done. And if I want somebody to do this for me, I pay for them and they do it. I want to go to a hotel room, I go there, I leave the bed, somebody else cleans it up for me, somebody, because my money is my power. So don't be arrogant. Put your faith in the age to come. Remember, ultimately, I'm only rich in this world. What I need to be is rich in the world to come. I've got to be generous and do good. That doesn't mean that I give it all away, but I need to be thankful to God for the money he gives me. For he gives me all good things to enjoy in this world. There's nothing wrong with a rich person enjoying the things of this world, but they mustn't be find their identity in it, and they must be generous. So when Paul tells the thief no longer to steal, he's to do work with honest hands in order that he may give to those who are in need.
Right.
And generosity lies at the heart of the gospel of grace, because grace is generosity. And so our attitude to money should be very different to the attitude of the world. The attitude of the world is acquisition of more money so that we can spend it on things, so that I can have things done for me. Whereas our acquisition of money is so that I can be responsible and not dependent upon others, but in excess so as to give away to those who are in need and help the world.
Can one of the difficulties for us be that if we live in the Western world, if we live in Australia, America, Europe, wherever, we actually are rich.
Yes.
But we don't think of ourselves as being rich. We don't recognise just how affluent we are.
That's right.
So all the rules about how you handle money if you're rich actually apply to all of us, even though we're just middle class people.
Yes. Christians are world citizens rather than national citizens. And I love Australia. I love the good things that Australia gives me. But we shouldn't be comfortable with the world being in as much poverty as it is when we are living in such affluence as we do. But you can't persuade Australia as a country to see that giving away 10% of our Australian national economy for the sake of helping third world countries, they won't do it. They won't come at it. It's just an unimaginable idea that Australia would grow in wealth so as to help the third world.
But we as individuals can.
But we as individuals can and should. Now, there are certain people who are concerned about it, and the government does give a small, tiny bit of GNP, but only under pressure. It's not a motivation that drives our society. And so, living in Australia, yes, we don't think we're wealthy. As I said, moving into other cultures helps us see it. Another one is going back to history. Before the Industrial Revolution, consumerism was only for the absolutely fabulously wealthy. What the Industrial Revolution did was give consumer goods, give affluence to a large number of people. And that's why consumerism is a disease of the Western industrial nations.
And that's where we are. We're the inheritors of that.
Now, yes.
If that means if the temptations of the rich are actually ours, then what are they? We're tempted to want more. The more we've got, the more we want. There's a temptation to be covetous all the time, isn't
there? All the time. And affluenza, as it is called. Yes. No matter how much I get, I want more. Affluence is a funny disease that we all have, where what was a treat just becomes a habit.
Yes.
And, you know, what was a treat becomes trite.
Yes.
So in our childhood, an ice cream was a big deal.
Yep.
Because we only had an ice chest at home. I don't know whether you had an ice chest or an ice...
When I was young, we had the man delivering the blocks of ice for the ice chest.
The ice chest. So you couldn't have ice cream at home.
No.
So you had to buy an ice cream at the shop. And it was a once-in-a-week treat.
Yes.
Likewise, going to the movies was a Saturday afternoon treat. Well, now I've got ice cream in my freezer.
And movies on television.
And I can just sit and eat bowl after bowl of ice cream watching this. And that which was a treat... It's just a habit, and it loses its specialness. So my children can't imagine that having an ice cream is a big deal. It's a nothing.
And if you're an affluent consumer, you then need to buy your own ice cream making machine because it's another gadget.
Yeah, it's another gadget, yes. I'll make better ice cream.
More exotic flavours.
Yes.
And the covetousness just rolls on without us recognising it's happening.
Yes, that's right, because I'm just rising with the standards around me. I'm not seeking to be the super rich. I'm just enjoying the rise of standards of our community.
So if the Bible is warning us against that, let's go back one step and define the word. What do we mean when we use the word consumerism?
There are several different meanings. It's not the one about looking after consumer rights. That's not what I'm talking about. That's a good and right thing. But it's the sense that being a consumer, consuming material possessions is the meaning and value of life. That I gain my meaning, my value, my significance, my security from owning, from buying.
Look at the car purchasing. I drive. Look at the house I live in. Yeah. Yes.
And most people don't think of it consciously. So, you know, we can make fun of conspicuous consumption. You know,
yes.
It's a word, a phrase that came 100 years ago, that phrase came into our... And we can say, oh, yes, well, he's got that car so as to look really good. And I'm not like that. But every time I buy a car, it's better than last time.
And I'm aware that that's the car I'm seen in. It becomes part of how I'm seen. And
some people do. I personally don't. But I do like all the knickknacks that go with
the little gadgets inside.
So, you know, the fact that I didn't have a tape recorder in one car. Now I had a tape recorder. Now I've got a CD player.
Yes.
Now I've actually got one that can play six CDs one after another. You know, in the first car, the only air conditioning was roll the windows down. Whereas,
yes.
You know, and now there's all kinds of gadgetry on the air conditioning.
And other people treasure the outside. So
yes.
Every Saturday, I wash the car.
Yes.
And if it's Ted Bulpett and there's a suggestion of a tiny scratch, he screams, "Not the Kingswood!" You know? So,
yes.
It's, we have to be careful not to be taken over by our possessions
That sense. That's right. And CDs and things like that. You know, a CD for music used to cost $20, $30. I don't know what they cost today. You buy them occasionally, but sit down and count them up one day and you realise you've got 100 of them. You can only listen to one or two at a time. You know, I mean, you can have six in my car, but I don't need a couple of hundred. And then you multiply it out, a couple of hundred by $30, there's $6,000 worth of... And I could listen to the radio and get it for nothing.
Yes.
I don't have control over what I'm getting from the radio. I've got to listen to whatever the ABC wants to deliver to me or whatever station I want to be on, but... Do I really need it?
See, there are people who, for them, it's a desire to possess it.
Yeah.
So I can listen to that recording of Beethoven's Fifth whenever I feel like it.
That's right. And you see how it's individualism?
Yes.
Rather than me share with the community on what we're listening to this week.
Yes.
I want to listen to what I want to listen to. You listen to what you want to listen to.
When we want to listen
when
to
When we want to listen.
So
I own and possess the world.
So you've already said that materialism... material things are not inherently bad.
No.
You once said the world is a good, but not good enough.
Yes. It is good, and it's there to be enjoyed.
Right.
And that makes it just a little tricky, because what we're dealing with, what's wrong is not the possessions. What's wrong is my heart.
The sinful heart.
Mm. Yes. That's the hard part. And it's selfish. And you think, yeah, but it's no more selfish than anybody else. And you say, yeah, well... That's where I live.
That's not the standard that we're
That's
meant to be
That's not the changing. Standard. And when everyone's being selfish, it's no wonder that a quarter of us live alone.
Yes.
And everybody will say, in all of the surveys that come out, you know, what's the most valuable thing in life? Family.
Yes.
But family requires you being unselfish.
And we actually invest our time and our money in our things.
Yes, yes. And our family joy comes not from... the things that we possess, but the time we spend in sharing them. It's the reverse. And so you can have a very happy family with very little possessions. You can have total misery with loads of possessions. But we keep on not giving time to family because we've got to go to this, and then we've got to go to that, then we've got to do this, and we've got to do that. And it's not just owning things. It's, you know, we've got to go and watch the football. We've got to pay and see the concert. We've got to go and learn the violin. We've got to... And so we're paying all the time, we're employing all the time, more and more people.
And demanding value for money from everything we invest
and
in.
And we can't just sit down and spend time with each other.
Yes. There, to some extent, even secular society recognises this, because secular society will critique what's going on.
Yes.
And so you talked about the expression conspicuous consumption. It's a critical expression, isn't
it? Yes. Well, it's 100 years old. We've seen it for years and years. But... secular wealth has no alternative. If you're
so
a materialist, then there's only materialism. I don't like it. It's shallow. It's empty. It's a nonsense. In fact, the producers, are producing things that will fall out of fashion or will break or will be superseded, especially so as to keep me buying more.
Yes.
We can all see its folly, but for the materialist, there's no answer.
And the word affluenza was coined by... ordinary secular societies as a way of saying what's going isn't working.
Yes, well, in the 1950s, Galbraith wrote the great book on the affluent society in the late 1950s, which is million seller, it's continuing on selling to this day. But you see, it's selling.
Yes.
That's what makes it a good book, it sells.
and books like that, critical books like that keep coming out. There's one in America called Fast Food Nation. And there's one about brands and how people have to buy brands and have the right. So the books keep coming out and selling, telling us that the way we're living is wrong, but it doesn't offer an alternative.
No, that's right. And it affects, affects sport. I love sport, always love sport, but I'm just so disillusioned with public sport now. They tell me to go to ovals, but I don't know where the ovals are anymore because they're named by brands rather than by suburbs or communities. Yes. So I've got no idea where this oval is or that oval.
Yes.
To watch competitions who are no longer named after their kind of Sheffield Shield became the Pura Cup or something, or the Milk Cup or something. and so I'm not sure who's playing what competition anymore. And then the people who are playing, because they're professional sportsmen now, it means that they don't actually belong to the community that they now represent. They're kind of guns for hire that are brought in.
Yes, Indian Premier League cricket was very entertaining, but teams were a mixture of Australians and Indians and South Africans.
Well, that was more honest than the others, though, because it didn't pretend to be the Indians. It pretended to be somebody charges or something like that. This is just sheer professionalism. Whereas the Australian rugby, the national team, is coached by an All Black.
I think outrage at that is reasonable.
How could be the Australian team? Anyway, you look amongst them and most of them aren't.
So everything is for sale.
The Italian team I saw the other day had a couple of Australians and a New Zealander playing for them.
Sooner or later you've got to wind back your outrage.
Well, it was like the Cleveland Browns that were bought by a man in Boston and moved to Boston. So the Cleveland Browns were actually playing in Boston. And you think, well, if I was in Cleveland, I might be a little
upset about that. Yes. You are a bit upset about things.
Well, that's just... The fact that people see that as normal is the indication that we're not understanding what a community...
We've made everything saleable. Everything's for sale for a price.
Everything is for saleable.
Okay. If that's the society we live in and we tend to absorb those values without realising it, how do we respond Christianly to that?
Yes. Well, the first thing is we've got to grasp that we live for the age to come, not for this world.
Right.
And we've got to remember that you can't love God and money. So there is a... I mean, it's a statement of Jesus. So there is a real serious issue that we have to grapple with here. Next is to say the problem's not the money. The problem's the love of money. So we've got to see that the problem is not the possession. Nothing wrong with any of the possessions that we're talking about. But our attitude towards them is critical. The next is it's always harder to negate an attitude in your mind and your heart than it is to put on an alternative. And so generosity is the best antidote to covetousness.
If I give it away, I can't spend it on myself, I guess.
And as an attitude, I'd like to earn more money because there are more people in need than I'm able to give to at the moment.
So we can't change society, so we need to work as individuals with changing what's happening to us and what we're aware of and what's going on.
Yes, and we need to talk to each other about it because it's one of those... diseases that are so hard to see. And you've got to be in the small Bible study groups we have around churches are really a very helpful way of this, where you can build up enough relationship with each other where you can, as a discussion, say, well, do we really need to have these CDs? Yes. Or do we really need to go to that concert? $200. I could buy a CD and listen to the same man over and over and over again for $30. And give the $170 to actually people in need. And then after a while you start to say, do I really need another CD? You know, why don't I just listen to the radio?
That's a hard breakthrough for people to make.
Yes.
I mean, we live in a society where people think going to the concert and having the experience would be really good, and I really, really want that.
Yes.
And that wanting is sort of consumerism, isn't it?
Yes,
that's
the heart
of it.
And it's not a bad thing. It's not evil to go to a concert and enjoy it.
Yes.
But remember, there are children dying of starvation.
Right.
Remember, there are people going to hell without the gospel. Remember that our missionary societies need millions of dollars. Put it in the perspective of eternity.
Maybe what we pray for helps us. If we're praying enough for missionary societies and for individual missionaries, You can't keep praying about something without being concerned about it, can you?
That's right. That's right. But if we gave 5% of our income to the local church, the local church would be massively oversupplied in money compared to what it is at the moment.
So although we talk about tithing as a minimum, we don't actually quite get to the minimum, do we?
No, nowhere near it. Right. And to have missionary societies facing difficulty economically in a country as rich as ours really shows the lack of genuine sacrifice in our hearts and minds.
Maybe we're not doing the calculation. I mean, we talk about tithing as being a minimum, but we don't ever sit down and say, now, what do I actually get? What would be a tenth of that? Because if we did that, we'd say, woohoo, that's a lot of money.
Hey, we'd also say, hang on, gross or net? That's the first question always,
isn't it? I think after tax.
After tax, yes. It must be after tax, yes, that's right. And all tax dodges too. No. The average Australian at the moment is earning $60,000 a year, which is tithing is $6,000. So, you know, it's $120 a week. Is that, I think, if my arithmetic's correct? So that's about $120 a week. And you think, oh, well, that's a lot of money to give. Well, is it?
Yes.
You know, is 120 a week an enormous amount of money? I don't think so, actually. You say, oh, but Philip, you don't know my circumstances. You know, I've got this big mortgage and all the rest. And I think, well, do we have to live in the house we're in? You know, can we downsize on this? And can we change that? There's this. One of the other things is an old friend taught me many years ago that he kept upping his giving. And he said the thing he noticed was after a couple of months, he didn't notice.
Yes, that's interesting, isn't it?
You know, the amount of money I have left over at the end is what I notice rather than how much I've given.
So this is something that's going to be hard to do individually. So if we could talk to our prayer and Bible study groups and keep each other up to the mark,
yes,
that could be a help.
Yeah, that's a great help. And your point too on the island, praying. You know, if we actually start seriously praying for the problems that are before us in terms of this world and its economic needs, we are so rich. And remember, Jesus said, those who are given much, much will be required.
Yes.
Well, we have been given.
So a lot's going to be asked of us, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So there you are. We've given you a lot of things to talk about in your Bible study group. And maybe if you talk about these things, you can keep each other up to the mark.